Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent considers Russia's intentions in the Middle East. A resident of Austria speaks with us about erecting a barrier to immigrants. From Capitol Hill, we look at the new U.S. Speaker, and we hear about what's hot in costumes this Halloween.
They're superheroes from decades-old comics books and TV and movies like Batman, Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, and Superman.
It's right here on The Voice of America. The conflict in Syria has drawn in so many nations, the U.S.-led forces, Russia, Iran, and other Middle East nations, and there's the forces of Bashar al-Assad and the various rebel groups. We're joined now by correspondent Jeff Seldon, who has been focusing on Russian involvement in Syria. Welcome, Jeff.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Do we understand what Russia's objective is in the region?
Well, for a long time, U.S. officials were saying they weren't quite clear what Russia was aiming to do as it got involved in Syria. They knew that for a long time, the Russians had been supplying the Syrian regime and President Bashar al-Assad with weapons and supplies. But as Russia ramped up and started sending some ground forces, and of course its airplanes and helicopters and additional equipment, rocket launchers, and started building up for a much larger footprint, at first they weren't sure. Now what U.S. intelligence officials are saying is that it's quite clear what Russia is trying to do. In the short term, it's trying to prop up, stabilize, and carve out part of Syria so there's a safety zone, there's a stronghold for the Assad regime. In the long term, though, the U.S. is convinced that the Russians really don't care what happens to Assad. CIA Director John Brennan said just the other day that the Russian long-term strategy is focused on cementing its influence in the Middle East. And for now, that means propping up Bashar al-Assad. But in the long term, whether it's Assad or somebody else, it doesn't matter to the Russians. The Russians want to maintain their influence and have a way of cementing their hold on events in the Middle East.
That's their bottom line. Well, how is Russia's activity affecting its relations with the entire region?
Well, the entire region has been up in arms, and it's interesting because at the same time that you have condemnation from some nations and anger from some nations, especially the Gulf countries, about what Russia is doing, because Russia is bombing not really the Islamic State as it claims, but according to Western intelligence officials and others, it's bombing the moderate rebels and the not-so-moderate rebels, many of which are being supplied and supported by the Gulf states and other U.S. allies. But at the same time, they've been talking to Russia. There's been a lot of outreach. Russia has sent diplomats and had visits, high-level visits with many of the countries. They've set up centers, coordination centers with countries like Israel, Jordan. They've talked to Egypt. They've talked to the Saudis. So at the same time that there's some condemnation, there's some talking. And what intelligence officials, what analysts seem to think is that Russia is trying to play both sides of the coin here. Russia, on the one hand, wants to secure its interests and support Assad, which puts it in line with Iran and groups like Hezbollah. But at the same time, it needs money. And the best way for it to make money, or one of the best ways, is through arms sales. And in that way, it's trying to reach out to these other Arab countries, these other countries across the region, because, as analysts point out, to get American weapons, which a lot of the Gulf countries like, there's a lot of bureaucratic process to go through. It can take some time. And the weapons, because they're high level, they're high tech, aren't always as quickly available. With as Russian weapons, they're not as good, but the pipeline is much quicker. So there's some thought that the Russians are trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Is there a sense of where this conflict is heading?
There is and there isn't. The French intelligence chief was speaking in Washington just the other day, and he said that the Middle East, as the world has known it, is no more. Mm-hmm. That the Middle East, the post-World War II Middle East that so many people have become accustomed to is gone, and it's gone forever. It's not coming back. He said that, will the region stabilize? Eventually, but how and when, he's not quite sure. There's a lot of concern about how you basically have these failed states in Iraq and in Syria, and if you extend to North Africa, in Libya, how much is this going to spread? And what is the impact going to be? How are these areas going to reemerge? What are the lines going to be? Is it going to be necessary territorial boundary lines, or is it going to be lines more along tribe and ethnicity and other factors that aren't traditionally seen when you look at a map? So there's a lot of debate. Former national Israeli National Security Advisor Yaakov Amidror also spoke at this one event. It was quite fascinating. And he said the biggest concern is the long term, because you have this de facto alliance between Russia, Iran, and the Iranian proxy Hezbollah, a terrorist group fighting in Syria. How does that play out? And from the Israeli point of view, in many senses, many of its enemies, like Iraq, like Syria, they're weaker. But over the long term, because of this instability, they see a lot more danger. So there's a lot of concern. And for anything that anybody thinks they know, they also are quick to admit throughout the intelligence community, there are a lot of variables, and no one's quite sure ultimately how this is going to play out long term. Short term, looks like there will be some negotiations. There'll be some talk. There'll be at least some attention paid to trying to get a peaceful solution. All players say, especially from the West, that there's no military solution. But whether a political solution can be imposed at this point is anyone's guess.
Okay, well, thank you for your insight, Jeff.
Anytime.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A couple of days ago, we told you about the discovery of a comet that dispensed large amounts of alcohol, sugar, and other organic compounds, much like a bartender as it made its pass by the sun last January. Now, researchers from the University of Bern say that after conducting a thorough chemical analysis, they found that the atmosphere of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko contains a high amount of oxygen molecules. Data gathered last year by the European Space Agency Rosetta Mission's Rosina mass spectrometer found clear traces of oxygen molecules in the comet's atmosphere. The German researchers say that it had long been thought that the presence of oxygen in our early solar system could be found only when it was combined with other elements, such as with hydrogen, which would form water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Austria announced Wednesday it is joining other European countries in erecting a barrier to bring order to the unrelenting influx of migrants and refugees fleeing war and poverty from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. My colleague Victor Beattie is here following this story. Victor.
Well, Susan, this is the latest challenge to the European Union's border-free Schengen area. Neighboring Slovenia has said it's ready to build a fence of its own, while Hungary has already put up a razor-wire fence along its border with Serbia and Croatia. On Tuesday, European Council President Donald Tusk warned lawmakers at the European Parliament that the flood of people threatens the European Union, destroying border-free travel and creating what he called tectonic changes in the European political landscape. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees announced more than 700,000 people so far have arrived in Europe this year. Dardis McNamee is a dual American-Austrian citizen who is managing editor of the Vienna-based Metropole, a monthly print and online publication that serves the English-speaking foreign community in the Austrian capital. She told me the concept of erecting a barrier is a very sensitive subject among Austrian officials.
All the officials are avoiding the word fence as if it had a contagious disease on it. They call it a controlled guidance, barriers, nets, various other kinds of things, but the reality is that you simply can't have this many people wandering across borders without any kind of processing at all, and that's what's happening. So the problem is simply that there are just too many people coming across. I mean, it's been doubling and tripling through that border, and they were set up for 2,500. So they've got, you know, almost three times as many as they can possibly manage.
Is there a hope that this will slow the migrant flow?
They have to get some kind of an agreement to help reestablish a government that is functioning in Syria in order to slow down the fighting and keep the ISIS enough under control that people can take the chance of being able to stay. Most of the people don't want to emigrate. There are always some who do, but most people are just hoping to be still alive by the time they can go home again.
Germany has been somewhat critical of Austria for allowing the flow of refugees and migrants to move through Austria on their way to Germany, saying they're dropping them off in the dead of night and they're not informing them of what their plans are.
This is what both, particularly in Bavaria, but now even the federal interior minister in Germany, has also been saying. The relationship between Germany and Austria has always had a funny kind of an undertone of the Germans thinking the Austrians are sloppy. The word in German is schlampig, you know, that they sort of are a little bit untrustworthy or they're a little casual about their arrangements. The reality is simply that everybody is overwhelmed. None of the processes are adequate, and they keep adding to them, and they keep, you know, increasing them by large numbers of buses or trains or processing centers, and it's never enough. I mean, every time they think they've got it under control, those numbers get substantially bigger very quickly. You know, the Austrians have organized a whole lot of buses to move people through the country. The agreement that they are free to move through the country and into Germany, you know, is an agreement. It's just the numbers have gotten too big, and so the numbers are suddenly bigger than what was agreed. Austria has already got 53,000 asylum applications here. In Germany, there have been 300,000, and if you figure that Germany is 10 times as big as Austria, it means that Austria has twice as many per capita as the Germans of applications from the people who are planning to try to stay here.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, a new U.S. Speaker of the House and going boo in style this Halloween.
A conservative stalwart, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, has been elected as the new Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. And joining on our line with us is our correspondent from Capitol Hill, Cindy Sain. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you.
Say, what does all this mean?
Well, Paul Ryan is one of the youngest people to be elected Speaker since the 1800s. He's only 45 years old. He's considered a bright young star in the Republican Party. And in an emotional day, he got 236 votes for Speaker. And he was welcomed warmly by Republicans and Democrats as he walked down that center aisle. He was hugging and shaking hands with just as many Democrats as Republicans, which is something rare around here.
Well, maybe you'll explain for us just why is this position in the House so important?
Well, this is one of the most powerful positions in Washington. The Speaker of the House is actually second in line of succession in case something would ever happen to the President and the Vice President. And the Republicans hold a strong majority in the House. The Speaker of the House, along with the Senate Majority Leader, is one of the most powerful people in Washington, along with the President.
And they can do a lot of political maneuvering to get bills put in, bills not put in, considered, not considered.
That's right. It's been a difficult time the last few years in the House, where the outgoing Speaker Boehner was embattled between Democrats on the one hand and more conservative Republicans on the other. And Ryan said, yes, the House is broken, but he said, we're not going to settle old scores. We're going to wipe the slate clean and start over.
Okay, so this is a move in hopes of getting Congress moving.
That's right. Congress passed a two-year budget and raised the debt ceiling on Thursday. A good start.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Cindy.
Okay. Thank you.
There are a lot of ways to follow the new U.S. Speaker of the House on social media. Michael Lippin joins us here in the studio now. Michael, where can you find Paul Ryan online?
Hi, Susan. Well, let me tell you, Paul Ryan actually has a couple of Facebook and Twitter pages. On Facebook, you can find his main personal page at facebook.com/PaulRyanWI. That's a WI for his home state of Wisconsin. And it's got an impressive following for a U.S. congressman, 4.9 million likes.
That's impressive.
It is. One reason why that figure is so high compared to other members of the House is that he was thrust into the national spotlight 3 years ago as the Republican nominee for vice president. Now, if you go to Ryan's Facebook page, you can find a graphic showing a map of his home state alongside a caption that reads, Speaker Fact, Paul Ryan will be the first Speaker of the House to represent Wisconsin, something he's clearly proud of. He's getting a lot of comments under that picture, many of them offering congratulations and wishing him well. But there's cynicism, too, with some conservative Facebook users accusing him of being a rhino.
A rhino?
Well, that is an acronym, and R-I-N-O, I'll tell you what it stands for. Republican in name only. That's a term that means a politician who claims to be a Republican but acts more like a liberal Democrat. Now, as House Speaker, Ryan is the leader of the House's Republican majority, but he also will have to compromise with Democrats to get things done. So he might face more accusations of being a rhino going forward.
A lot of name calling up there on the Hill. Well, where else can you find Ryan on social media?
Well, his other Facebook page is at facebook.com/speakerRyan. Obviously, that's a new title that was just adopted a few hours ago, and it's a sign that Ryan's social media team was quick to present his new role to the social media world. The Speaker Ryan Facebook page has 176,000 likes, still far below his personal Facebook page. And I'd just like to add that Paul Ryan also has two official Twitter accounts. One is his personal account, at P. Ryan, with 675,000 followers. And the other account has the new handle, at Speaker Ryan. That's got 484,000 followers, almost all of whom were already following the handle under its previous name, at Rep. Paul Ryan. Now, if you in the audience want to share your thoughts about Paul Ryan, just tweet me at Michael_Lippin. You can also tweet the show at VOA_IE. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called Robohan, a smartphone that's also your personal assistant. The big deal about Robohan is it has voice and face recognition. At a technology show just outside Tokyo, future customers got a chance to preview the phone made by Sharp.
It's capable of various things. There are many kinds of ways to use it.
Robohan was made to talk to you, to announce new emails, scheduled appointments, birthdays, etc., etc. Robohan is also, of course, a camera, and with its head-mounted projector, it can display media on almost any flat surface. Is this device practicable? Well, walking down the street with its head in your ear while you're talking to its feet may not be the look you're going for, but Sharp says the robot phone is mostly just for fun. A good backup or secondary phone. It's expected to be available in Japan sometime next year. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
It's nearing Halloween, a time to dress up in costumes, trick-or-treat for candy, and tell scary stories. In my neighborhood, folks have sprayed their bushes with phony spider webs, hung scary signs on the doors, and put jack-o'-lanterns and pumpkins on their front porches. Doing research on this year's trends in costumes is my colleague Deborah Block, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Susan.
What a great assignment you got.
Well, oh, lots of fun.
Well, what's hot this Halloween?
Well, the biggest trend this year are nostalgia costumes. They're superheroes from decades-old comics books and TV and movies like Batman, Spider-Man, Wonder Woman, and Superman. And a lot of the costumes are also from or being inspired by movies like Star Wars, which is a real favorite this year since a new chapter in the movie series is coming out in December. And in the store that I visited, one of the largest in the Washington, D.C. area called Total Fright in Arlington, Virginia, says that the number one villain to dress up for Halloween at that store, people are coming in and buying costumes of Darth Vader, that evil, infamous guy from the Star Wars films.
He is a scary one and a lot of heavy breathing, too.
Yes, he is.
What about politicians? It's political season.
Oh, it's no surprise that, you know, political costumes and things like masks and other items are in demand. In fact, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump masks were the big item at the store that I visited, and the Trump masks had already sold out. And what's also very popular and has been over the years since he's been president is Obama masks. This store also has a really funny pumpkin Obama. It's like Obama's face in a pumpkin. That's pretty amusing. And one thing that also caught my attention, which was really a lot of fun, is this store has a lot of fake hair, you know, wigs. And there were a couple of styles of Donald Trump hair that you could put on your head for Halloween.
The sweepover, the famous sweepover.
That's right, sweepover.
I heard costumes for animals are really big this year.
Oh, more than ever. You know, Americans love their pets. And this year, the pet stores went all out in putting in a lot more costumes than they ever have. And they are really fun. Now, the trend there is the same as the humans, the superheroes. You can dress your dog or cat as Batman or Wonder Woman or Spider-Man. The other things that were trending for the animals were kind of funny. They were like hot dogs and hamburgers that you could put on your dog. So if you had a long dog, you could put a hot dog on them. And also, another thing that was trending was putting something like a cowboy riding on top of your dog, which looked pretty cute. And, you know, there were a lot of animal costumes for the animals. So you could dress your dog as a cat or your cat as a spider, or you could put a shark or a bumblebee on your dog. And the people I saw at the store I visited were having a lot of fun trying on different costumes on their dogs in particular.
Well, thanks, Deborah, and happy Halloween.
Yeah, happy Halloween to you, Susan.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and happy Halloween!
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States prides itself on its cultural, ethnic, and religious diversity. Each group of immigrants, whether it arrived in mighty waves in a short span of time or trickled in over decades, even centuries, made its contribution to every aspect of life in the United States. Without this diversity, we would not be the nation we are today. But not every group is well represented among the U.S. population, and that is why every year the United States government makes available 50,000 permanent resident visas to the citizens of countries with a low rate of immigration to the United States. Registration for the 2017 Diversity Visa Lottery, also known as the Green Card Lottery, began at 1700 hours Greenwich Mean Time on October 1st and will end at 1700 Greenwich Mean Time on November 3rd. Only nationals of countries sending fewer than 50,000 immigrants to the United States over the past 5 years are eligible. Other eligibility criteria also apply, such as the attainment of certain levels of education, vocational or on-the-job training. For detailed information about entry requirements, along with frequently asked questions about the program, please go to http://travel.state.gov/content/visas/english/immigrate/diversity-visa/instructions.html. All applications must be filed electronically. No paper applications will be accepted. So if you are eligible for the lottery and wish to immigrate to the United States, please visit the website at www.dvlottery.state.gov. Find the link to the lottery application at the bottom of the page and fill it out as soon as possible. Once you have emailed the entry, you will receive a confirmation page. Print it out and save it. It contains your registration number. Only by using this number will you be able to check the website to see if your entry was selected. Enter only once, as sending more than one entry will disqualify you. All winners are chosen by a random drawing. And remember, entry into the lottery is free. Anyone asking for money to help ease the process is running a scam. Once again, that website address is www.dvlottery.state.gov. Enter now, and good luck to you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.